friends, to Voices of the Sacred Feminine, whether you're across town or across the globe. Thank you for tuning in and spending your time with me tonight and my wonderful guests. I know you have lots to do and your time is valuable. And if you like that musical opening, it was part of a cut by Diva Haley's Sacred Alchemy DVD called Love, Lover, Beloved. Well, if you're new to the show, I'm your hostess, Karen Tate. I'm the author of two acclaimed books, Sacred Places of Goddess, 108 Destinations, and its bookend, Walking an Ancient Path, Rebirthing Goddess on Planet Earth. Whether you're an armchair tourist or you actually get out there with your tennis shoes on the ground, or whether you're a solitary practitioner or part of a group looking for fresh ideas to incorporate goddess-inspired living into your life, well, I invite you to check out my website at KarenTate.com and learn more about my books, tours, workshops, and our Sacred Sunday services held every fourth Sunday in North Hollywood. While you're there at my website, please take advantage of the free downloadable meditations. They're my gift to you, my listeners. And remember, please, Blog Talk is not free to hosts, and contributions are welcome. I pay out of my pocket to give my guests a platform to teach and share their wisdom. There are PayPal buttons on my Goddess store page if you'd like to make a credit card contribution, or you can always send a check. Email me at KarenTate108@ca.rr.com if you'd like to mail in a contribution, large or small. And I want to thank Chris for that recent contribution she made. It's much appreciated, Chris. Well, tonight is my pleasure to have on the show Robert Moss discussing an interesting technique called active dreaming. Some might call it contemporary shamanism. I think we've talked about it before when I interviewed a guest about Jung's Red Book, but Robert will correct me if I'm wrong. Then later we have with us author Elizabeth Davis discussing her book, Women's Sexual Passages. Well, do you remember that sound, those bees? Well, it's been some time since I've had a What's the Buzz segment on the show when I share with you the bees buzzing around in my bonnet. And this is a short one, so I'll ask Robert for his patience. And it goes like this. These are the bees that just incessantly keep buzzing around. With the election year upon us, soon the GOP, the Republicans, will be picking who they believe will be their best hope to beat Obama this coming November. I know the GOP primary season looks like a circus act, and from talking to some of you on Facebook and elsewhere, well, I'm hearing several schools of thought that worry me. The first is, well, you're mad at Obama and don't want to come out and vote for him. Well, let me suggest to you that the people in Wisconsin, Ohio, Michigan, and all those other states with Republican-controlled state congresses probably wish they had come out to vote for Democrats November before last. Then they wouldn't be fighting these culture wars on contraceptives and rights for workers and gays and unions. They'd not have to put their energy into repealing laws jammed down their throat, recalling governors, or have to worry about voter suppression. Think about it before you decide to stay home and not vote for Democrats in November. Secondly, if any of your friends say Obama can't lose going up against these nut jobs, no one is going to vote against Obama and for Santorum or Romney or Gingrich, well, think again. What I hear is Obama is not doing that well in the polls and swing states, which he needs to, win the whole country. Evangelical Christians and racists and homophobic voters are riled up, and they are passionate. They hate Obama. They'll do anything to beat him and put someone like them back in the White House. So when you or your friends say they're staying home and can't be bothered to vote, maybe you could have a conversation with them that goes a little bit like this. Well, you know, we always scratch our heads and think how average Republicans are kind of short-sighted when they always seem to vote against their economic interests. Well, you know, I've been thinking maybe not voting for Obama is voting against our economic interests, because the GOP will just roll in the Ryan plan, you know, more tax cuts for the rich and the destruction of Medicare, where grandma gets a voucher when she's 80 to go see what kind of health care she can buy on the free market. You know, they're against Social Security, too, and would get rid of it. And let's not forget, they're against the minimum wage and have been wanting to repeal child labor laws, destroy unions. The GOP, those Republicans, have shown over and over they're for the privileged class. No, I'm not happy that we haven't gotten everything Obama promised, but I can certainly say I'm better off with a Democrat in the White House, and I know we'll be much better off if we can take back control of the House and keep the Senate. Let's not have any regrets this November, like November before last. Let's go out there and sweep the GOP from office so we can move forward and not go back. That's what I'd say anyway. You have to see if that feels right for you. Well, that's my 2 cents for tonight. That's what I'm telling my friends who want to stay home or lodge a protest vote for a doomed third-party candidate. So I appreciate you listening and want to say thanks, and I welcome your comments. And remember, you can catch any show of Voices of the Sacred Feminine from the archives, and you can also listen via iTunes as well. So stay tuned in, call in if you like, and the number is 718-766-4662. So without further delay, I want to thank Robert for his patience, and I'll tell you a little bit about him before we actually begin our chat on active dreaming. Robert Moss, he is the creator of Active Dreaming, an original synthesis of modern dream work and ancient shamanic techniques for healing and journeying. Born in Australia, he survived 3 near-death experiences in childhood, and yes, we will ask him about that. He leads popular seminars all over the world, including a 3-year training for teachers of active dreaming. A former lecturer in ancient history at the Australian National University, he's a best-selling novelist, journalist, and independent scholar. His 8 books, yes, 8, on dreaming, shamanism, and imagination include Conscious Dreaming, Dream Ways of the Iroquois, the 3 Only Things, The Secret History of Dreaming, Dream Gates, and Active Dreaming, and his website is mossdreams.com, M-O-S-S, dreams.com. So, Robert, thank you for being on the show tonight.
Good to be dreaming with you, Karen, and I quite like the buzz. I mean, I like what you said after the buzz, but I must note the bee is one of the most ancient allies of the goddess. The names Deborah and Melissa in Hebrew and Greek, respectively, are ancient titles of the priestess of the great goddess. I mean, honey bee, and I mean priestess of the goddess. And I, though a mere man, have dreamed of bees, have taken me to very interesting places since I was quite young. And when I go to the Baltic, I'm about to teach in Lithuania for the fourth time, I'm in a realm where Ostea, the bee goddess of the Baltic, is still very active in the rural life of women and in the lives of men who appreciate all of this. So I was quite glad to hear the buzzing of the bees for those reasons.
Well, you know, my listeners know quite a lot about the Melissa and the bees, and I'm glad to know you do too, because I can't say all of my guests would. So there you go. We're already on common ground there.
Well, somebody called the host of one of my programs last year in California and said, the program sounds interesting, but I don't know who Robert is. And my host said to her simply, oh, you must know this about Robert. Robert serves the goddess, at which point, of course, she came to the workshop. And actually, at that location later this year, we're doing a program called Dreaming with the Goddess. So I'm just a man, but I have an appreciation for these things to such an extent, Karen, that when I heard that lovely song, which is from the Arabic, there is no God but God, I kept wanting to add S to the God. I mean, you're the sacred feminine. You have no God but God. I mean, where's the feminine there? Well, there is, of course, but we need a word in English that embraces these things better than the old word G-O-D.
Yeah, absolutely, and that does rile a lot of people up, you know, when they just hear the male version.
Well, particularly coming from a tradition that doesn't really value women very much overall. Of course, I'd be beheaded in some of those places for saying that I want to sing There's No God But the Goddess, but I'll say
you
it
and
anyway.
Me both. They would quickly have me in a burqa
both,
and buried
course.
Up to my neck in sand and stone in my head.
I know, certainly.
So let him talk to the hand. but anyway, Robert, let me just say, you know, speaking of bees, you know, I used to lead sacred tours. I haven't done one in a while, but we led a group to Greece once, and we went to Delphi. Uh-huh. And one of our most magical experiences was at Delphi when we were collecting sacred water right there where the Pythia used to bathe. And the place was surrounded by bees. And some of the women were sort of afraid to go collect their water. You know, they were afraid they'd be stung or whatever. But it was my husband, who is very much a goddess advocate. He's so in touch with the sacred feminine, loves women, loves the goddess. He said, well, ladies, I'll go get the water for you. So he went there. He went with all of our water bottles, walked right into this thick mass of bees. Not one of them stung him. And he felt blessed. You know, he felt as if they were a gift.
Right. Well, you have good taste. You married the right guy.
Oh,
and,
for 27
and Greek
years.
Tradition, as you probably know, the sites of a number of very special places. I not quite certain whether Delphi is one of them in the tradition, but there are certainly several sites that fit this description. Several of the sacred sites were revealed to the people who proceeded to use them by bees flying, usually to an entry into the earth, which had not previously been noted. So bees have been the guardians and escorts to interesting realms where humans can connect with the more than the surface world offers.
Well, that's really interesting. Well, and please say again, I couldn't quite catch it. Where did you say you're about to give a talk on the bee goddess?
Oh, I didn't say that. I'll have to slow down. Some people say, particularly when I go to California, I guess that's where you are, you're from New York, and I say, is it the accent? They say, no, it's the speed with which you move and speak, so I'll slow down. I'm not giving a talk on the bee goddess. I was talking about the programs I lead in the Baltic, particularly in Lithuania. Lithuania is the country in the world where the tradition of the Melissae, of the bees, and of the bee goddess, whose name in Lithuania is Austeia, is most alive. If you want to know the real shamanic tradition of the bee, don't read the books that claim to be about that. Go to Lithuania and find people who know and are still celebrating the ancient ways of the bee goddess Austeia. So I was talking about my personal connection with a living goddess tradition in an old European country, the country of Lithuania, where the bee goddess is still understood and revered today.
And how are you spelling her name? I haven't heard that goddess before.
Well, her name is spelled Austeja, Austeia.
Okay. Well, and I'm wondering if by chance, I know Maria Gimbutas was from that general area. Has she written
anything?
She is from Lithuania. Yeah, I thought so. I was digging deep back in my memory. I'm wondering if she's written anything about that particular bee goddess.
I have most of her books. She began and ended her great and brilliant career with books about, or chapters in books about ancient Baltic spirituality and religion. I don't recall finding that many pages about Austeia in the writings of Maria Gimbutas. Of course, she is wonderful and essential on the civilization of the goddess, as she came to call it in general. She was from Lithuania. Unfortunately, she died in the 1990s. I never had the pleasure of knowing her, but I have friends in Lithuania and elsewhere who knew her very well, and I followed her career beyond what has been published in her books. And she is the absolute model of someone who can meld direct understanding through dreams and visions and intuition with immense scholarship. She's a great linguist, a great anthropologist. She was fluent in at least 20 languages, and she brought together all these signs and symbols of the goddess from all over to give us a picture, a scholarly picture, informed by the most rigorous intellectual discipline of what the goddess civilization in the old world might have been like. She made a tremendous contribution, and in my own work, I draw upon her. Part of my work is what I call cultural soul recovery, trying to connect people authentically with the old traditions, I mean, along authentic paths. I mean, I've been a professor, I've been an investigative journalist, I'm not a New Age type. In my approach to all of this, I'm actually Paleolithic. This is very ancient age stuff. This is the ancient way of the shaman. But to do that today, we must marry it to the best of scholarship and use the most rigorous intellectual tools we can as well.
Well, let me start with the question that, the reason why when I saw you on Facebook talking about active dreaming, am I right or wrong that Carl Jung, in his Red Book, talked about active dreaming?
Jung did not use the phrase active dreaming. What Jung did talk about is active imagination. That's probably what you're thinking about.
Okay.
An active imagination derived from Jung is one of the more interesting Jungian techniques. And Jung at one point late in his life actually said he did not want to see any patients anymore unless they're willing to do active imagination, by which he meant unless they're willing to do some work, some play with their dreams and images for themselves, not just take it from him. He was a very impressive professorial authoritarian male, and he had a hard time in face-to-face encounters giving people their full power, but it was his intention to do that. He tried to do that against his own character in a sense. Active dreaming is my original phrase. I mean, I've been using it for a long time now. I only just made it the title for a book. My most recent book is called Active Dreaming, and it's a provocation. It's a provocation in this sense. When people think about dreams at all, they tend to think of them as passive experiences. You go to sleep, you have a dream, you don't know whether it means anything, you're confused about it, and that's what dreams are. Well, active dreaming, the phrase implies a couple of things far, far beyond that. It implies that we can learn to go consciously or intentionally into the dream space. I teach people to do that in everyday ways and in quite profound shamanic ways. I teach people to make the shaman's journey, often using a personal dream image, a personal portal from the night, to travel with drumming, with breath work, with intention, to do something interesting, like face the terror and resolve it, like talk to your dead grandmother and find out why she was in your dream, like learn to travel in the multidimensional universe by these techniques. I also teach people everyday things like hanging out in the in-between space between waking and sleeping, in the hypnagogic zone, in that liminal zone, and doing fun things there. But active dreaming is about more than techniques for shifting consciousness. It's about getting active with our dreams of the night, our dreams of life and everyday life. It's about learning to talk to people in fun, mutually empowering ways about this stuff and getting juice for the day and getting guidance for action. So active dreaming is an original approach. I founded my own school. I'm not a Jungian. I'm not a Freudian. I'm not even a Mossian. I am Robert, and I have my own school, and we now have several hundred people who've done the 3 years of the training all over the world and are bringing it into communities and different environments all over the map.
Okay. Well, I find this fascinating. And just indulge my one last question about active imagination, then we'll focus entirely on active dreaming. What's the difference between active imagination and active dreaming?
Well, I've just given you an overview of what active dreaming is. Active imagination is an interesting but more restricted technique. I mean, it's a good technique, and my approach has many things in common with it, but it's basically saying you have an image, a personal image, do some work with it, play with it. I mean, unfold it, stay with it, see if you can change it. And all of that is good stuff. I mean, I'm a great friend of Jung. I'm not a Jungian. I've written about Jung's red book in my new book, the one coming out in June, Dreaming the Soul Back Home. I wrote about him in my first book on dreaming, conscious dreaming. I've described Jung as the very model of a shaman of the West. You want to know what a real shaman of the West would be like? Look at Jung. Look at how he knew things. Look at what he survived. Look at his initiation, a terrifying initiation, if you read the Red Book all the way through and understand what is going on. And then look at how he took what he had experienced and put it together with the best of his scholarship, with the best of his depth research, and made a model of understanding for himself and others. So I am a great fan of Jung. And active imagination is an excellent technique, which certainly you could say we practice. But active dreaming is a broader approach. Let me add this, and this is very Jungian again. Active dreaming is also about making conscious choices in waking life and looking at the events and content of the day as a set of dream symbols. We do a huge amount of work and play with synchronicity, a word Jung invented, with looking at the symbolic pop-ups and recurring patterns in waking life, with studying anomalies in the day, deja vu, time switches, things like that, that begin to give us a hint of the deeper world. But all of this is very pragmatic. I think Jung at the end of the day was a pragmatist too. As you can see, I'm making comparisons rather than differentiations between what I did and what Jung did, because Jung is one of my heroes and exemplars.
Okay. Well, all right. So let's start focusing, for the rest of our show. We have about 45 minutes on active dreaming. First of all, can anybody do it?
You've got the material. How far you're going to go with it depends on practice. On devoting a little bit of time. You know, Malcolm Gladwell said in his book Outliers that it takes 10,000 hours of practice to get really, really good, to get excellent at anything. Dreamers have an advantage if they're willing to do the practice. I mean, we have the material. All of us dream every night, even if we don't remember. Even the hardhead who says, I don't dream, is just saying, I don't remember. We have that material. We know from the study of what's going on in the sleeping brain that everybody is dreaming during sleep. And it's not just about sleep. It's not even fundamentally about sleep. I mean, we have the ability to enter lightly altered states of consciousness through daydreaming, through hanging out in the twilight zone of hypnagogia and so on. We have the ability to get messages from coincidence and symbolic pop-ups in the world around us. So in that sense, we have the material in us and around us all the time. It's really just a question of waking up to the power that is waiting for us to claim if we will claim it. So
now,
we have the material, and beyond that, the material that comes to us through dreams and through meaningful coincidence is fresh, it's spontaneous, it's authentic, it belongs to us. If it comes to us that way, that means it's time to play with it, it's time to do something with it. Whereas sort of hand-me-down approaches may or may not be appropriate for us on a certain day. So this is waiting to be discovered by everyone.
All right, so when we're talking about active dreaming, are we just talking about what happens when we go to sleep at night, or are we talking about, lucid dreaming during the day or anything like
that?
We're
talking about more than both of those things that you've mentioned. We're talking about more than sleep dreams. We're talking about more than lucid dreaming. This is a far more expansive and powerful approach. I value night dreams, sleep dreams, especially the ones we do not ask for and do not want. Why? Because they hold up a magic mirror to our actions and attitudes in which we can see ourselves more clearly, and also because they give us clues to what is happening and what is going to happen in the world about us. Dreams are routinely rehearsing us for things that lie ahead. We see the future very frequently in our dreams. If we don't know that, it's because we haven't paid attention, haven't analyzed the dream material for messages about the future, and haven't done anything with it. That's one of the very basic fundamental things I teach people. You want to do better in life, then learn to look at your sleep dreams and ask, could any of this happen in the future? And then ask, if you don't like it, can you do something to change it? And if you do like it, what can you do to move towards it? This is one of the reasons cross-culturally why humans have valued dreams and dreamers as far back as we can trace, that they have understood that dreams give us a preview of what lies ahead, and we can use that information to do better. So for these and many other reasons, explained in my books, sleep dreams are of the greatest value, and we want to learn to work with them. Lucid dreaming is a particular technique. We do some of that, but we go beyond it. Lucid dreaming is basically a technique for waking yourself up to the fact that you're dreaming and then consciously navigating in the dream space. That's fine, but I teach people to start out conscious and stay that way, and that is the easiest way to become a lucid, conscious, or active dreamer. You start out, you learn to shift your attention, you learn to journey like a shaman, you learn to go beyond this ordinary world into a deeper world through appropriate portals with appropriate intentions. You have great adventures. And then, Karen, you learn that this is not just a solitary activity. You can do this with other people. You can learn to dream consciously with others. I lead regularly flights of 30, 40 people traveling together on an agreed itinerary, bringing back fantastic results. We're using shamanic drumming and other techniques to help them in the workshops. But, this stems from the ancient understanding that dreaming is not just a solitary individual matter. It's not just about individual psychology. It's a social, transpersonal activity. We can learn to do it together. So I think I've answered your question rather comprehensively. This values sleep dreams highly.
That's
it values
true.
Lucid dreaming, and we go beyond all that.
I get it. Okay. So from what you're saying, I was connecting a bunch of dots as you were given that explanation. What do you think about dream incubation that the ancients used to do?
Well, the ancients did it, and we do it today. We tend to do it with less ritual and less complicated methods, but I suppose if you have a very big intention, a very big need, then you might want to adopt some of the preparations that the ancients used too. It's as simple as this in everyday life, and I recommend it. You have an issue. You have a question. You have an intention. Set yourself up for dreaming by writing down as simply and clearly as possible what you would like to do during the night. It can be as simple as, I'd like to have some fun tonight in my dreams and remember. You might need some time off. I'd like to go to Hawaii tonight and not pay for the plane ticket. You might need guidance on the job, the relationship, or something else. So you set yourself an intention. If you're new to this, or if the intention is very urgent or very heavy, you might want to do some special preparation. You might want to do a special ritual of your own. You might want to pay attention, for example, to what you eat and drink before you go to bed. You might want to light a candle or put out an object that is special to you, or do something of that order. I recommend dream incubation. I also recommend that you don't do it all the time. You don't, especially not if these are very large intentions. And I recommend doing it in a generous and open way, by and large. For example, when I approach sleep, I will sometimes say, setting the intention for dream incubation, show me what I need to see. You better be ready. You better be ready for whatever comes after you set that intention. I might say, I would like to wake with my energy and creativity restored. And that's an interesting intention. There may be little dream content, but there might be a shift in energy and a sense of direction when you wake. I might say, I open myself to my creative source. I might say, I ask for healing for myself or for someone else. Those are examples of setting the intention. There are many ancient prayers and rituals for dream incubation, and I've guided people into modern ones. Often in my workshops, we will sing a very simple version in English of a song that was sung in the Asclepion, in the Temple of Dream Healing of Asclepius in the ancient Mediterranean world. And the words are very simple in this English translation. The words are, "Healer of all, come blessed one." And sometimes I send people off to dream in the night when we're doing residential workshops with the song, with the music on their lips and in their minds. They approach sacred sleep in the way that people did in the temples of dream healing in the ancient world with those words of invocation, "Healer of all, come blessed one." The results are sometimes spectacular.
Okay. Well, now what about when someone has a dream and they don't know how to interpret it themselves? Because I'm sure, I hope you'll tell me, I have not put a lot of stock in these dream books that interpret symbols, because won't symbols mean different things to different people?
Yes. If I'm in favor of book burning, and I want to say quickly I'm not in favor of book burning, I would burn all the dream dictionaries, particularly the best ones, because they tempt people to give their power away and to hand the interpretation of a dream over to a set of explanations. That doesn't work. Yes, we recognize something of our dreams in other people's dreams. Yes, we dream universal themes. But in addition to that, any dream has its specific individual twist and spin, and you don't want to miss that. You don't want to just say, well, I dreamed of water, I dreamed of falling, or I dreamed of being naked in public. Yes, we can comment on a dream reduced to a phrase of that kind, but the specifics of your dreams are different. For example, I dreamed I was naked in a situation in a dream last night, and I want to understand the situation. I know that if I'm naked in a dream, it sometimes got something to do with whether it's okay for me to expose myself. There might be other themes for you, but I want to understand, where am I? Where am I where it seems to be okay for me to expose myself? Because nobody's troubled by the fact that I'm naked, except that I'm sort of aware of it. So, you don't want to miss the individual specific guidance of a dream. So where do you go for guidance? Well, one of the things is you learn how to talk about your dreams in the right way to the friend who is going to share your dreams with you. And by the way, when you find that friend and learn to talk together the right way, you're going to make an incredibly rich and rewarding and creative relationship, which will be a great support to you in life. Possibly the most important single thing I have introduced is a quick method for everyday dream sharing that I call the lightning dream work process or the lightning dream work game, because you can do it in a few minutes with just about anyone, just about anywhere. You create a safe space to tell your story, tell your dream or another story for that matter, get helpful feedback and be guided towards action all in a few minutes. When this process is better understood and is played between people, between groups, between families, we will all do better. And the person commenting on your dream is not going to tell you what your dream means. I don't allow that. I don't allow anybody to play expert on anyone else's dreams or anyone else's life. What anyone can learn to do is to give you some feedback from their point of view. So I tell you my dream of being naked in public, and you just say to me right off the bat what you would think or feel if it were your dream. And you begin very politely by saying, "If this were my dream, I'd think about such and such," which immediately means that you are owning your projections. You're not playing authority or interpreter to me. You're just saying what you think. You don't have to be an expert. You don't have to be right. Whatever you say will guide me along. So, yes, I mean, this is the way. This is the way, and it's fun. And when people learn to do it, they bring juice and joy into every morning or whatever time of day they're going to share their dreams.
Well, I bet you must be excited about that new TV show that's started, Awake, where the guy has these alternate realities going on.
I didn't manage to see it last week. I was flying to Hawaii to lead a retreat, but I'm going to try and catch it tonight. I've heard the plot. It sounds interesting. I noticed that they've borrowed one element in the plot from a wonderful movie made several years ago with Demi Moore called Passion of the Mind. I'm just saying this from what I've read about Awake. In Passion of the Mind, Demi Moore lives in a split reality. In one world, and you're not clear which is dream and which is physical world, in one reality she's discussing her life in the other world with a shrink. In the other reality she's discussing her life in the other world with another shrink. And both of the shrinks are insisting that the other shrink is a dream figure. Apparently they borrowed this element for Awake, and some people say it's the most interesting element in the film. I just want to say that it has a history. And that's fine. We borrow good ideas. It's been said that mediocre awake are writers plagiarize, good writers steal. But there's a prehistory to awake, and I'll be curious to see how it is. I noticed, by and large, that Hollywood is beginning, picking some of the TV series, is beginning to catch up with some things that are pretty important for us to understand, and they're beginning to give us some exciting scenarios to help us to understand them. One of the most exciting things for us to understand is this physical world that we call reality is only one of many worlds in the multidimensional universe in which we have our lives, and there are things that can begin to bring us awake to the existence of other orders of reality within which what goes on in our surface life may have its origin and its meaning. So these TV shows, I'm a particular fan of Fringe. I only caught up with it on DVD. I don't really make time to watch regular TV shows. It's another one where they explore dreams, alternate reality, deja vu, and all of that,
right,
and the way
right.
that people come awake to a deeper game.
Yeah, well, yeah, and you're right. That is what they do in Awake. You have the two shrinks, each trying to convince
yeah.
the guy that, you know, they're the real one.
Right.
Well, so, but along that, along those lines, from, you know, some of the stuff we talked about, we would talk about in the interview, am I right to assume that you think we can lead an alternate life in our dream? I mean, that seems so, you know, too complex. I mean, can that actually be done?
It's not complex when you're doing the dreaming, Karen. It's not complex when you're just catching your dreams and following them. The easiest way to understand these things is not to fret about some scientific model of the multidimensional universe, but to look at your dreams once you've started recording them and collecting them, and notice the dreams that seem to run in a series in which you seem to be somewhere else with other people, maybe in this world, or maybe in a different reality altogether. That is how you get firsthand experiential knowledge of the reality of parallel universes. I believe in parallel universes. I also believe that we can learn to draw lessons and guidance and power from our parallel selves who are walking in parallel with us in alternate realities right now. I've written about this in my books. I've written most about this so far in Dreamgates. Dreamgates is my book for the real adventurers, those who are really, really ready to go out boldly and become full citizens of the multiverse, and in Dreaming True, in a final chapter on dreaming and future science. So I've written about this. I've collected many, many experiences. Let me note, I've been keeping a dream journal since I was a teen. I have tens of thousands of my own experiences. I teach thousands of people every year, and although I cannot record and retain all of their experiences, I keep quite a sampling. I get tens of thousands, no hype, of emails and messages from people who want to share their experiences. I can't process all of those, but I would say that I am sitting on an immense personal database of experiences relevant to this. Relevant to what? Well, relevant right now to the reality of parallel universes and the possibility that we can learn about these things firsthand and maybe change things for the better as
okay.
we learn safely to explore and connect with our alternate selves and alternate realities. Very
right,
exciting
so,
stuff. This is leading
right.
edge stuff. And by the way, this
Robert,
is one of the reasons
Robert,
why I maintain that dreamers will be at the heart of our future science, the heart of our understanding of reality itself and our ability to shift it for the better.
Robert, take a breath so that I can get a word in edgewise
uh-huh.
here. I said, take a breath.
Well,
so
I don't
I
believe
get
in dead air.
In...
I've done some radio myself.
Well, there's, believe me, you won't have dead air with me, I promise. I actually do ask questions.
Uh-huh.
So let me ask you about astral projection. Does that factor into this at all?
Well, of course, but, you know, let's be clear about it. Let's be clear about whether we're talking about astral travel or astral projection. This
so
is
what's
an
the difference?
Distinction. Astral travel is when you travel in consciousness without necessarily losing track of your body and without necessarily projecting a dense energy body that is getting around. Astral projection is, or an out-of-body experience tagged as astral projection, is typically when you leave your body in a second body, sometimes a quite dense energy body as well as a light astral body, and you get around and you lose track of where you were and you may forget where you left your body and where your home is. Astral projection, certainly. I mean, you know, if you want to do it, be careful. If you want to do it, learn psychic protection because you can get into bad neighborhoods and what happens to your dense energy body can impact your physical body when you come back. Astral travel, traveling in consciousness wherever you want to go, is much safer and much more interesting, and it's fundamentally what I teach. Yeah, in any of my workshops or simply using the techniques in my books, you can learn to project consciousness and go where you choose to go quite easily. And You don't have to have the experience of being sort of bumps and grinds of leaving and returning to your physical body in a dense energy body, which can be problematic if people don't know how to defend themselves psychically.
Okay. So now you were alluding to the idea of parallel universes in question before, this last one. When you talk about parallel universe, is that where, say, the departed may exist? I mean, do we actually get messages from the departed in our dreams, and are they on some parallel universe?
I wouldn't mix up the term parallel universe with the afterlife. I mean, it's possible that in some of the parallel universes, as I gather in this TV series Awake, that people that we know who are alive here have died and so on. I mean, that so the discussion could certainly go in that direction. But for simplicity, I don't in my own mind tag the realms of the afterlife, the departed are at home, as parallel universes. They are a separate reality. It may be near or far to us. I mean, here's one of the things about dreaming. In dreaming, we have easy and natural contact with the departed. Why? For three reasons. Because they're still around, they haven't moved on, that can be good, bad, or mixed. Or because we visit them, we go traveling in our dreams, and we go to regions where the deceased are at home, or because the deceased come and visit us. It goes on all the time, it's going on every night. The number one reason throughout my life when people have wanted to tell me dreams, actually, outside workshops, has been they've dreamed of someone deceased who was in the family or a friend, and they want to know how to work with this dream. Is it for real? How do they feel about it? What should they do? So we have that contact all the time, and I would say it is through dreaming, in the broad sense, dreams of the night, visions, astral journeys, that we have developed our opinions about the afterlife. All our religions, in a sense, come from dreams and visions of this kind, because all of them promise some kind of afterlife and some kind of destiny for the soul. Where does that knowledge originally come from? Before it's ossified and conventionalized by churches, that knowledge comes through direct experience, through dreams, visions, near-death experiences, and astral journeys. So, in fact, I've written two books which are basically about this. One is The Dreamer's Book of the Dead, and the other is Dream Gates, which has one of whose four parts is called A Manual for the Psychopomp, A Manual for the Guide of the Soul, which involves learning the geography of the afterlife and how to come and go safely from those places. And in my workshops, I lead journeys to explore many different localities in the afterlife. The afterlife is larger in its geography than this planet. I mean, there are many different versions of the afterlife. You go to different places according to your understandings, your desires, and your preparation. So we do a great deal of first-hand exploration of the realms where the deceased are at home.
So, you touched on your near-death experiences. Now, you said you survived three as a child. Tell me a little bit about them, and how does that impact you now in this work?
Well, we didn't have the word near-death experience when I was a kid growing up in Australia. Raymond Moody, who I know, invented that much later, and was a useful term because it sort of sounds respectable. Oh, yeah, we've heard of that. When I was a kid in Australia, the doctors would just say to my parents, oh, poor bloody kid, he died and he came back, didn't he? It happened to me the first time when I was three. My great aunt, who was an opera singer, friend of Dame Nellie Melba, and a very gifted, though discreet, psychic medium, she saw my impending death. She didn't want to talk about it. She was right. I died that winter, a very tough winter in Tasmania. And I don't remember much about it, except that having been a robust and healthy boy, age three, I then spent the next 8 years of my life in sick rooms for at least half the time with 12 cases of pneumonia in both lungs, a sort of allergy to the world, and two other immense crises, life or death crises of illness. So my life changed. I don't remember much of what happened when I was three. I've tried to go back and look at it, and I have various impressions, but I don't have absolutely clear memories from that time. What I remember indelibly and in great detail was what happened when I was 9 years old, and I've written about this, and I'm happy to talk about it if you want to hear the story.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to hear the story?
Yes, yes.
So I'm nine. I said to my father, I feel a bit crook. In other words, I feel a pain down in my abdomen. He doesn't ask any questions. He calls an ambulance. He knows I'd already learned not to complain about pain because I knew so much of it. I'm rushed to the hospital. I have an emergency appendectomy. My appendix is about to blow up. I'd just been in hospital the week before with pneumonia. And this is what happens. My body is in the operating room. My consciousness is on the ceiling looking down, not enjoying the spectacle or the talk among the nurses and doctors. So my conscious self leaves my body in the OR and goes down the corridor, and there's my mother crying, and I don't want to see her pain. I'm 9 years old. I want to do the thing that healthy boys do. I want to go along the beach. I want to go down to the theme park, Luna Park, down there along the waterfront in Melbourne. So I go down to the theme park. I've forgotten I left my body in the bed. I'm going to ride, go on the rides for free. I'm having a good time. I go on the ghost train, and suddenly there's traction. I'm pulled down into a world inside the world, it seems, and I'm with beautiful, pale, elongated people who are humanoid, but not exactly human. They welcome me. They receive me into their family. They raise me as one of their own. And Karen, in my experience, I live a whole lifetime. I grow to manhood. I become a father and grandfather. I become some kind of elder or shaman of this people. I have a good life. That body is used up. I'm cremated. I start to rise on the smoke of the fire. And instead of going to a home in the stars, which is where I'm expecting to go, I'm pulled back into the body of a boy, a 9-year-old boy in a Melbourne hospital room, who lost vital signs and has been out of his body for a few minutes of ordinary time.
So you're saying,
and
you
I
lived,
remember.
So you're
and
saying you lived an entire life in those few seconds.
I lived
that,
a whole life in a few minutes.
Okay.
As we can do. And I remember. And I'm growing up in a conservative era in a military family in Australia, and there is nobody to whom I can talk safely about this. You know, the doctors, oh, poor kid, he's hallucinating, isn't it? It's the medication. The first person I met who could confirm and validate this kind of experience was an Aboriginal boy, and I was not supposed to hang out with Aboriginal boys. Australia was very racist in that area. An Aboriginal boy who was very matter-of-fact, he said, oh, yeah, we do that. We get sick. We go and we live with the spirits, and then we come back. So he gave me a model of understanding. If I'd been growing up in the island of my great-aunt, no doubt they would have said I'd gone away and come back. I went away, and I came back. So from my early childhood, I have known that for me, the physical world is only one of many worlds. This is now the opinion of modern physics. It's not just the opinion of ancient shamans and mystics and poets. It's the opinion of superstring theorists and others who are talking about other universes which are there but are lost to ordinary sight. I've known this from my childhood. So I've done various things in my life, and I've used the dreaming, and I've used the intuition that comes for a true dreamer to navigate the hazards of ordinary life. But behind all that has been my understanding that there are deeper worlds. And what I've learned to do is to guide people to visit these worlds safely without the extremity of an experience like that, to learn something about the multidimensional universe for themselves without going through that kind of extreme situation.
So, all right. This begs the question, and maybe it's a little off subject, and maybe it's not. From your experiences, your near death experience, just everything you've learned through to the point where you're at in your life at this point, what do you think we can expect after death, or does it depend on what we expect?
Well, I think the last phrase was very helpful. It does depend on what we expect. You are probably likely to find what you expect until you learn to expect more or learn to expect the unexpected. For example, if you've been taught by your religion that you're supposed to go to sleep after death and stay asleep until the last judgment, you might try and stay asleep. I've met people who have died who are still trying to stay asleep because that's what they were told they would expect, and they keep waking up and they feel they're very bad members of their religious denomination. I've met other people. I mean, you know, you're talking to somebody who's had a lot of contact with the deceased. Not in the mode of the psychic medium, who is, you know, having lots of things fluttering around in their aura, but in the manner of the shaman, who chooses what he or she encounters and will journey into these realms and see these things in context. I've met people who were taught that there's no afterlife at all, and they're having a very hard time understanding that they have died because they still feel pleasure and pain. They still have a body or the semblance of a body. So sometimes they go back to the old place and stay with the living because they do not understand that they are dead because they weren't prepared for it. I've met people who are clinging to the old haunts, the old pub. They're trying to get the next fix, the next smoke, the next sex or whatever because they are completely addicted and they're still stuck in the heavy energy bodies and they're having the hardest time moving on because they have no idea that they want to move on.
So
all
is that
of these
what
people,
a haunting
course,
is?
Are
is
lost
that what you
or
would
confused
describe
or bound and need help?
Is that a haunting?
Well, it might be a haunting if they bother you. It might be, and a haunting will happen if something bothers you, and if it bothers you, it's probably because it wants to get your attention. it might want to get your attention because it thinks that you're intruding on its space. It might be trying to get your attention because it wants your help. Remember in Ghost, where the Patrick Swayze character has to persuade her girlfriend that he's around and does things that are pretty strange, physical things, because she won't believe in the non-physical?
Okay.
So, you know, I mean, where you go and where you go and what happens to you after the further stages of the journey is very much open to your imagination or lack thereof, to your desires, to your wishes, to your intentions. I mean, there are people who want to put themselves in a collective belief territory and stand around singing praises of some form of God. Well, if that's your intention, good luck to you. I don't think I want to stand around singing endless choruses of praise myself. I have a Mohawk friend. I had to learn the Mohawk language because of my dreams, another of my adventures. The Mohawk Indian friend said to me at one point, Robert, you know, when you die, you're not going to the same place as me. I said, thank goddess, I like your people, but I don't want to live in a Mohawk, traditional Mohawk version of the afterlife. Nor do I want to live in a traditional Tibetan Buddhist version. Nor do I want to live in the Unitarian version. There's a wonderful cartoon. I have many Unitarian friends and speak at their churches. There's a wonderful cartoon about Unitarians. It shows a group of Unitarians entering the afterlife, and they come to a sign. And the sign is a two-way sign. There's an arrow that says paradise, and then there's an arrow that says discussion about paradise, and all the Unitarians are going to the discussion about paradise. I don't spend my afterlife in a discussion about paradise either. You know, I've been to a number of places on the other side. I don't have a fixed intention about where I want to stay for all time, but there are certainly some very interesting environments where I would like to spend some more time, one of which resembles a very pleasant institution of higher learning.
So I think you would, in your afterlife, you would probably just be a perpetual seeker, and it would probably suit you just fine.
Well, I think we want to be perpetual seekers, don't we? I mean,
some people, yes. I mean, like you and I probably, but there are some people who like to live in a narrow little box,
and they just want to sit on a cloud with God. That's an option that's available too, till you get bored with it.
Right. Well,
in my book Dream Gates, I describe a journey that a woman made in one of my workshops to visit her deceased mother, and she found her living in a whole planet of her own that was about the size of a football. It was from the outside, like it was a metal football, and inside there's Mom in the easy chair, watching an old TV show she used to love called As the World Turns, and eating Waverly wafers, an old-time snack she used to love. And the daughter's with Mom, and the daughter says, Mom, what are you doing here? And Mom says, don't interrupt. I want to see the end of this TV episode. So talk about staying in a box. Mom is staying inside this football-sized world, watching the old TV show, and going on with that for a certain length of time. I think eventually Mom will come awake and want something more, but that's where she was at that moment. You can't even call it her transition. That's not a transition. That's her place of stuckness on the other side. People get stuck on this side and they get stuck on the other side too. But the options, Karen, are as immense or as narrow as the imagination. It's like that.
Well, that's liberating. I like that. Well, now I'm sure I'd be remiss. I feel like I can hear my listeners screaming to me through the airwaves. ask him what happens if we don't dream, if we can't remember our dreams. How can we get more in touch with our dreams?
Well, you can get my book, Active Dreaming, and you can put it under your pillow. But before you put it under your pillow, you can read the chapter called Breaking a Dream Drought, which has some very clear and practical advice, which is going to work for you, on how to break the dream drought and get in touch with your dreams again. And here's something very simple, which I haven't seen in anybody else's books, that I will say here. Be kind to fragments. What does that mean? It means when you wake up and you say you don't remember anything, pause and ask whether you don't have maybe the tiniest little something from the night. Maybe there's a soundtrack going through your head. Maybe you have a taste on your palate. Maybe you have a sense of color. Maybe you have just the wispiest, minutest kind of little memory. Take that, write it down, and play with it. I remember a woman who said that she'd lost her contact with her dreams and was disgusted because she didn't dream, continued to refuse throughout a residential writing workshop I was leading, continued to refuse that she was remembering anything. I said, I don't believe you. You remember something. She spat at me, I remember a blob. How's that? I said, how interesting. Describe the blob. A red blob. What's the texture? Paint. House paint? No. Oil paint. A blob of oil paint, does that bring anything to mind? Suddenly, She was back in her memories of something that happened when she was 9 years old, and she went to the studio of her mother, a professional artist, who had a blob of red paint on her palette, and she needed help. Something bad had happened. She needed her mom, and mom screamed at her, "Get out! I told you never to interrupt me when I'm working." At that moment of memory, coming from the blob, the fragment from the dream, opened a process of profound healing. So, you know, give yourself a chance. Don't flunk yourself and say you've got nothing. You may have a blob. And do this. You still don't have anything to play with. Look at the world around you. Look at the symbols and coincidences and synchronicities cracking all around you. Carry a question into the world. Say to yourself, "I would like guidance on something or other," and see what the world gives you. It might be the vanity plate on that car. It might be the movement of that bird. It might be something else. The world is speaking to you in symbols and synchronicity all the time, all around you. And it's a funny thing. When you start opening yourself to the play of coincidence and symbols in everyday life, sometimes that brings the night source of dreams back into operation also.
Okay. And so what about nightmares? Are they something to really worry about, something we should overcome, or is
they're
it
something
just
to work on? They're opportunities. I'm in favor of nightmares. Your listeners can, you know, switch off now if they like. If something is screaming at you and you have to run away from it, it's something you most certainly want to deal with it with now. And when you learn to deal with it, you'll be grateful that it's coming at you. What you leave, a nightmare is an unfinished dream. It's a broken dream. It's not just a scary dream. You left it broken and unfinished because you wouldn't face it. What you want to do is learn to turn around and face the issue on its own ground. Sometimes what is terrifying you is your own power. I mean, in shamanism, this is very well understood. If the tiger or the wolf or the bear is going to be your ally, you will be scared when you're first making acquaintance with the tiger or the wolf or the angel, for that matter. Every angel is terrifying, said Mr. Rilke. Angels are not just cute crystal shop things, not when you first meet them. They wake you up. They stun you, shock you out of your received opinions and comfortable habits. So what you might be fleeing from, leaving as a nightmare, is your own power. Or you might be running from a warning you need to pay attention to. Your dream, your nightmare might be telling you, if you don't take action, you'll get sick, you'll lose your job, your relationship will collapse, or something like that. You want to get that message clear and act upon it and use it to do better. Here's one of my personal mantras, one of the mantras I made up about dreaming. Dreams are not on our case, they are on our side. That applies to nightmares. Nightmares are not on our case, they are on our side. When my youngest daughter was 4 years old, and young children are wonderful dreamers, we should listen to them. They are the masters of dreaming. She came into my space in the middle of the night and said, "Dad, I'm having a scary dream." I said, "Yeah, tell me." She says, "Two yucky monsters were chasing me." Okay. She didn't seem too scared now. So what happened? She said, "Oh, I put on a dragon costume and I chased them back." That's the natural shamanism of children. In the morning, she said to me, "Daddy, do you know what happened to the monsters after I chased them back? Tell me." She said, "They're now rainbow-colored birds that live in my pillowcase and will help me out when I need help." That is a whole shamanic process. And that she did that not because she's my daughter, but because kids understand these things much better than fraidy cat adults sometimes do. And adults need to listen to kids better to understand what dreaming is all about.
So what is dream archaeology?
Well, dream archaeology is another of those phrases I've made up to describe a process by which we can marry the gifts of the shamanic dreamer to travel in consciousness with the gifts of the scholar and the investigator to bring back authentic, direct knowledge of things that are not in the books that will connect us with ancient tradition and with soul on a cultural level. In my books, I've already written a certain amount about how this is conducted. In my new book, Dreaming the Soul Back Home, which comes out in April, there's a chapter called Cultural Soul Recovery in Dream Archaeology, where I describe experiences of leading groups of people, particularly in Lithuania, to recover the old goddess traditions through group journeys followed by specific research. In one of my own journeys in Lithuania, I picked up words of archaic Lithuanian that had to be interpreted with difficulty by the Lithuanian speakers there, and then researched through the museums and the archives of images going way back. So it's about our ability to connect with the necessary past, the useful past of the ancestors, and get to the meaning of things by these techniques. I'm working now with people who are following in Maria Gimbutas's tradition, following in her footsteps, to help them to learn how to marry the techniques of shamanic dreaming to literal archaeology, linguistics, and other scholarly tools, so that we can follow the clues of dreams and use dreams to get further levels of meaning, as well as using the techniques of science and scholarship.
So now, Robert, for somebody who's just starting out, you have a lot of different books. What would be the best one for them to start with?
Well, I'd jump in. I mean, I'd have a look. Go to my website. Go to one of the online booksellers. Have a look. I mean, a good place to begin would be with Active Dreaming. It's the most recent, or with another recent book, The Three Only Things. The title is explained by the subtitle, Tapping the Power of Dreams, Coincidence, and Imagination. There's not much overlap between my books. I have a low boredom threshold, and I don't just go around repeating myself. They're all full of fresh stories, adventures, techniques, and so on. But those ones, Active Dreaming and The Three Only Things, are very good ones to begin with. They'll give you tools that you can use every day. I mean, this is everyday practice. It will be fun, and they'll give you stories to encourage you to claim your own bigger story and to use these often dismissed resources of dreams, coincidence, and imagination more actively in your life.
Okay. Well, my final question, and then we'll have to wrap it up for tonight because I see my second guest has shown up on the switchboard. Are you planning to be down in the L.A. area giving a workshop anytime soon?
Well, I'm coming to California three times this year. I mean, L.A. people are capable of traveling a little bit north, aren't they?
Where are you, actually? Town
north of San Francisco in June for Dreaming the Soul Back Home, which is a workshop about soul recovery and shamanic healing as well as dreaming. I'll be in Placerville for Dreaming with the Goddess in September, and I'll be at Esalen for 5 days for a 5-day retreat, Way of the Dreamer, in November. So you can find all of this at my website, mossdreams.com, which you mentioned.
Wonderful. Well, Robert, it's been fun. We could really have filled the 2 hours, but I thank you for giving us a chance to sort of, briefly touch on all the different, aspects. I'm sure we just sort of, barely scratched the surface, but it's provocative. I like the subject, and I want to thank you for your time tonight.
Well, thank you, Karen. Here's a dreamer's wish for you. May your best dreams come true. And may you remember them.
Yes, may I remember them. That's my problem.
That will change after now. This is viral. This is contagious. You spent an hour with me. You'll dream differently now.
I'm going to hold you to it.
Okay. Well, hold yourself to it. Okay. Sweet dreams, Karen. Bye.
Same to you. Good night. Well, listeners, if you're just tuning in, this is Karen Tate, hostess of Voices of the Sacred Feminine, where we discuss goddess, the divine feminine, and the resurging interest in right brain thinking and the feminine consciousness. Whether the great she be deity, archetype, or ideal, and how these new values and benchmarks have the ability to save the world. You've just been listening to Robert Moss, the creator of Active Dreaming, giving us some tools to go inside and understand ourselves a bit better. And we talked about bees at the top of the show. I just want to make a point to tell listeners that if you stay with me through the end, I'd like to keep that theme going. I'm going to close the show with the bee mantra by Lane Redman. But I see our second guest, Elizabeth, is actually on the switchboard, so I'm going to unmute her and say hello.
Hi, Karen.
Hi, Elizabeth. Thank you for calling in.
Sure.
Well, let me first start with introducing you to my guests. I'm going to go ahead and read your bio so they know a little bit about you. Elizabeth Davis, she's been a midwife, educator, and women's health specialist for 35 years. Her books include Heart and Hands, A Midwife's Guide to Pregnancy and Birth, Women's Sexual Passages, Finding Pleasure and Intimacy at Every Stage of Life, which is what we're going to primarily focus on tonight. Also, she's written The Women's Wheel of Life and Orgasmic Birth, Your Guide to a Safe, Satisfying, and Pleasurable Birth Experience. She served as Pacific Regional Representative and the Education Committee Chair for the Midwives Alliance of North America, President of Midwifery Education Accreditation Council, and consultant to the State of California's Alternative Birth Methods Study. She holds a degree in holistic maternity care and is an NARM certified. is NARM certified. She's a co-founder of the National Midwifery Institute, a three-year accredited program. So, Elizabeth, I have to say, what pops out at me right away, and I'll say right off, I have not birthed a child, but the title of your book, Orgasmic Birth, Your Guide to a Safe, Satisfying, and Pleasurable Birth Experience, I hardly think of giving birth as orgasmic, but that's probably just my ignorance, right?
I guess. You know, I have to tell you that I came upon orgasmic birth personally after having a really traumatic first birth back in 72, in a time that I call the dark ages of childbirth. I wanted a midwife. I had been reading and I looked for one, wanted a home birth, and couldn't find anyone to assist me. But with my second birth, well, let's just say that first birth, it marked me in ways that I'm still recovering from, but it also set me on my path. And my second birth, well, I was fortunate to find a midwife. I was really concerned with not tearing because I had a huge episiotomy with this first birth, which is, if any listeners don't know, it's a cut to enlarge the vaginal opening, which I don't really think was necessary. My son was only 6 pounds. And I knew this time I had an 8-pounder, and I just went inside myself at that moment and really tuned into what I was feeling. And the more I felt what I was feeling, the more the sensations, the breathing, the rhythm of all of it became orgasmic. And I won't say that it's orgasmic in the sense that we ordinarily think, the contractions of orgasm per se, but the physical sensation, the sensitivity, and the great moment of release. Well, yes, it was.
I see.
I said nothing to anyone for many years because I thought if I did, people would think I was crazy.
Well, yeah, I mean, the pain of childbirth, you know, seems the opposite of orgasm, but the way you just described it, it does make sense.
Well, you know, it's physiology. And the more that I have studied this and written about it over the years, you know, oxytocin is the prime player in birth. It's the hormone that causes uterine contractions. And interestingly enough, it is also the hormone of orgasm and sexual arousal, only at levels 10 times greater. Hmm. Now, many women don't know this because they're in circumstances either because of their own belief system or the environment in which they give birth, where the hormone that opposes oxytocin, adrenaline, is at high levels. So the possibility, the potential for orgasmic birth under those circumstances is almost nil.
Well, this is maybe a crazy question, and I know we're supposed to be talking about women's sexual passages, but forgive me, I find this interesting. I wonder if, and I don't know if you can answer, but this just popped into my head. I wonder if in ancient times, I feel like we've lost so much knowledge, especially women have probably lost so much knowledge with, you know, the degradation of patriarchy and all of that. I wonder if there ever was a time when childbirth was a different sort of experience for women, and it wasn't just this, you know, horrendous, you know, pain-filled experience that so many women, I would imagine, must fear.
Well, I think so. You know, I've looked at various, you know, anthropological surveys of birth in other cultures, and it's pretty interesting to see how when women are attended by other women and when there is an atmosphere of trust in the process and when women are allowed to follow the course of their own labor in an atmosphere that is relaxing and conducive, and in the same way that we pick an atmosphere for lovemaking that is private, that is quiet, that is dark, when women had that opportunity and had the counsel and the humor of other women, I think orgasmic births was quite common.
Well, and I'm also thinking, too, I mean, when we were in Hawaii and we went to what was supposed to be a traditional Hawaiian village, we saw what they called the birthing stone. And
I saw them. I was just in Hawaii. I just saw them.
Okay. So
I was just there.
So for listeners who don't know what we're talking about, women literally squat over a stone rather than laying on their back, and gravity help the baby exit. And, I mean, again, you know, I've never given birth, so I'm talking about stuff I don't know a whole lot about. But just logically, that seems like that would be more natural rather than having to push so much, you know, let the weight of the baby exit out. I mean, does that not make sense, sir?
Sure. I mean, what happens when you're on your back or even semi-reclining is that all of the pressure of the baby's head is against your spine. You have no room to open your back. You know, now that we know more about the physiology of birth, we realize that women will instinctively choose a forward-leaning or squatting position where they have range of motion to more or less wiggle the baby down.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when you're on your back, another thing happens, that pressure of the baby's body against major vessels often causes fetal distress, panics the birth attendants in hospital, causes them to say, oh, my God, we've got to do an episiotomy or use forceps or vacuum to get the baby out, or even say, oh, we've got to do a cesarean. And I must say that our cesarean rate in the U.S. has reached an all-time high of 33%.
I was going to say, I've heard that partly has to do with doctors just being lazy and wanting to, you know, deliver babies on their schedule. But is there anything to that,
it's not just laziness. It's you know, we are in a litigious society where people expect a perfect outcome. So cesarean is, in terms of any kind of legal proceeding, it's a completely acceptable practice under almost any circumstance, defensible. You know, in home birth studies, the cesarean rate is about 3.7, so this is a very dramatic difference. And there is something that happens in hospital that a lot of women don't realize. It's called the cascade of interventions. And this is something that really every woman should know about. You know, you go into the hospital, maybe you are essentially normal and healthy. And because you don't have privacy, your adrenaline levels spike, your oxytocin drops, and a doctor comes in and says, you're not progressing, we really should give you this artificial oxytocin, which is called Pitocin. And that makes contractions so extraordinarily painful and actually a little too strong, to the point where women understandably want pain relief. They get their epidural, and that slows the forces of labor. So more Pitocin is added, too much for the baby to handle. Now there's not enough oxygen in the uterus. Now we have fetal distress, and suddenly we have a cesarean in a situation where everything was completely normal.
So it's just a matter of them not wanting to let it take its natural course. It takes too long. Is that it?
And not even knowing. I mean, I know it's hard to imagine that the average obstetrician is ignorant of the physiology of birth or lacking in the skills to promote spontaneous childbirth. But all you have to do is read an obstetrical textbook and you'll find it's true.
So now, how would it be different for the woman that gives birth at home or with a midwife? I mean, is that not sort of scary because you're not in a hospital if something goes wrong?
Well, midwives, I'm a certified midwife. We have a national credential for certification. That means that I understand that I screen all of my clients to be sure that they are low risk. And I have the tools, the assessment tools. I do the lab work the same as a physician would do. I continually palpate the baby for growth, for position. I look at the mother's blood work to be sure she's not anemic, that she's in good health. I evaluate her diet. And if at any point in the pregnancy she becomes, in my mind, high risk, then I cannot continue to care for her at home. So to begin with, I'm dealing with women and babies that are very healthy at the time of labor.
Mm-hmm.
And then during the labor, I also monitor. I listen to the heart rate. I check all of the mother's vitals. I do internal exams to be sure the baby is descending and in a good position. And again, if anything comes up that is worrisome, I transport.
Okay.
And even for those last-minute emergencies, which sometimes occur, like hemorrhage, like shoulder dystocia, where the baby is stuck at the shoulders, or occasionally due to whatever cord problem, something may occur that causes last-minute fetal distress, I'm trained in neonatal resuscitation, and I have all of the equipment.
Okay.
So I'm ready to handle those complications.
And how different is the environment delivering a baby with a midwife rather than the hospital setting?
Oh, this is so wonderful to me in your home. It's so wonderful to have all of your own comfort accoutrements. You know, you can choose, you can make your environment as conducive to relaxation as you want. You can rent a birth tub. You can be in the bathtub. You can have dim lights. You can have any kind of aromatherapy or candles that you want. You can look at, contemplate sacred objects or photographs, anything that you like to induce relaxation and concentration. That's where the orgasmic potential really, really comes in. It can be quite an exquisite experience. And I think the most important part of this, people think orgasmic birth, how hedonistic. But really, you know, if you don't disrupt those hormones, those are the hormones that promote bonding. And when mothers and babies have strong bonds, breastfeeding goes smoothly, postpartum recovery is easy, and women launch into motherhood with confidence.
And I would imagine from what you said that I think you called it the cascading effect. Was that it?
Yes.
That doesn't happen with you because you're not rushing the process.
Midwives understand that labor is it is a process. And there are certain points in labor that we call plateaus. They happen at particular predictable intervals. And they're really points of integration where women will sometimes take some time, 4 centimeters, 8 centimeters dilation, and sometimes as the baby is just starting to emerge, take some time to integrate physically and psychologically before going on. This is well documented in midwifery literature, but in the hospital there's a different standard for progress that was actually predicated on the research of a guy named Friedman who took an average of length of labor, and from this average was extrapolated an expectation of how many centimeters per hour we're supposed to progress, when in fact women's process in labor is it's kind of like our process with orgasm and sexual process, which really is, we open up, we become excited, and then we plateau. And we open up a little more so we can have more sensation, integrate, and then we go on to the next level. Labor is very similar. And midwives understand this. They continue to monitor mother and baby, but they allow this because they know it's normal.
So will that plateau, I mean, are we talking about a time period that may extend over a couple days as opposed to, you know, less than a day in a hospital? Or?
Well, the first plateau is around 4 centimeters, and at this point the woman is not even in active labor. So if she is plateauing at this point, she may get tired. We understand it's important to nourish her, to do whatever we can to encourage her to get sleep so that her body is rejuvenated and she's ready to go on. When you get further into labor, plateaus typically last for no more than a few hours. And often, just by talking to a woman about what she's feeling or what she's fearing or what's going on with her, big changes can happen really quickly.
I see. Okay. Well, Elizabeth, let's switch gears here a little bit and go into the intended conversation, women's sexual passages. Let's start with the fact that they're explain what you even mean by that, women's sexual passages.
Well, I guess, when I was a relatively young woman, I guess I had just had my daughter at home, and I was looking for a better method of contraception. I didn't want to take hormones because I wanted to breastfeed, and I didn't want anything to interfere with that. I started observing my fertility. I started looking at fertility awareness for myself. And what I discovered in the process was that, you know, miracle, I had much more desire when I was fertile. And also an interesting second peak right around the time that I approached menstruation. And this was different than what society had told me, which was basically I should always be on sexually. And I started to research this, and I discovered that, in fact, women do have rhythms of sexual desire that are, you know, they're predictable by cycle. And I think this is important for all women to know, that we're not always on. And the more we understand our rhythms, the better we can take advantage of them.
Well, and I would think it would be great for our partners to know, too.
Yeah.
So that they know when to come looking and when to just leave us alone because we'd rather have a book.
Yeah. Well, you know, they've done studies on women when ovulating, and they found that in every type of testing, from physical endurance to intelligence testing, women are literally at their peak. It's also research of how women dream during ovulation. It's very different. Women dream of their mothers. They dream very sentimental dreams, softer dreams, than they do when they're premenstrual. Those dreams are much more aggressive, maybe even dreams with strangers. It's a whole different landscape. And when women speak openly and honestly, as they did to me in the research for this book, that the nature of that peak is it's very different. It's the other side of the story, but it's also very strong.
Okay. Well, and are you familiar with some of these new movements afoot, like the Red Tent and the Red Web, where women are starting to get more in touch with their menses and basically have a better relationship with it and don't think of it as the curse and all of that sort of stuff?
Oh, yeah, I think it's great. I think it's so wonderful. And, you know, I think there's great potential in women getting together at this time. There's something that I share in the book, a story from Native American culture, where women had options to go to the menstrual hut or the red tent. And there in that location, they would often have vision. It was said by Native American cultures that the coming of the white man was foretold by the women of the Moon Lodge.
Mm.
And I think there's something powerful for us in terms of our mutual dreaming and visioning in being together at that time.
So you would agree, I mean, that was actually where I was going with this, is so you would say from your research then that you have all can also conclude that when a woman is on her menses that she is more psychic, she is more maybe intuitive.
Yes, and looking at that psychic capacity at that time and also when ovulating, I began to suspect that oxytocin was the missing link in women's intuition. And in fact, I've been able to verify that and conclude that with levels as high as they are in labor, there is no time when women are more intuitive or more in the big space than when they're giving birth.
So you're now, saying, you know, so when they're giving birth, they're in that more intuitive state?
Yes. The trouble is that, again, in hospital, a lot of times when women are given artificial oxytocin, that pitocin I mentioned earlier,
mm-hmm.
it stops oxytocin production. And unfortunately, there are no brain receptors for the artificial form. So women don't have the changes psychically. They don't have the changes in brainwave frequency that they do with oxytocin.
Well, that's really interesting.
Yeah, it's something that, again, I think every woman should be aware. You know, what's been shown is that when oxytocin levels are extremely high, as they are in labor, we go into the deepest brainwave state that we can consciously know, which is called theta. And in theta, we experience distortions of time and a very deep knowingness. So that I've learned over the years that, yes, I have my expertise as a midwife, I have my skill, and this is what I bring to the table. But I will never fail to ask a laboring woman what she thinks she needs, what she would like to do, and where she thinks we are in the process, because often she's got better ideas than I do.
So I would imagine there probably is not a way to stimulate a woman's natural oxytocin.
Oh, yeah. There's definitely, I mean, here's the thing about oxytocin. It's been called the shy hormone because a lack of privacy. You want to have a really wonderful lovemaking session. What will you do? You're going to be sure your cell phone is off. If at all possible, you're going to eliminate interruptions. You're going to pick a time where nobody will bother you. You want to have a locked door, maybe, or at least a closed door. The lights are dim. The music is quiet but evocative. You set the tone. And this greatly stimulates the release of oxytocin, whereas anything that makes you feel that you need to track or think or worry or stay on top of it disrupts that. And this is due to a stimulation of the neocortex. When the neocortex is stimulated, adrenaline releases. Bright lights, people talking, observation either by another or by yourself can diminish oxytocin release. It's the same way that, you know, if you're making love and you're wondering if you're doing it right,
then you're not releasing oxytocin.
You're not going to. Right.
Yeah, so
exactly.
You really just have to, okay, that makes total sense. It's almost like left brain, right brain. You know,
yeah.
You get out of your left brain, and that's when the oxytocin can be stimulated. So
right.
So that's in lovemaking. But say, for instance, you wanted to release oxytocin for trance work or psychic ability. Would you sort of do the same thing? It just sort of set the mood, but the intention is maybe not, you know, to make love. It's for vision.
Oxytocin is also called the love hormone because, amazingly, we can release oxytocin at the mere thought of being with a lover. We can become aroused, lubricated, without physical contact. Mothers with small babies, upon hearing the baby cry, will have letdown of milk without stimulation to the nipple. So just by running the energy of love, we release oxytocin.
Okay.
Now, there are many ways that we can move into that theta frequency that I mentioned earlier. We can do it with meditation. We can do it with various breathing techniques for trance work. But ultimately, the energy that we're speaking of is the energy of love.
Well, and I'm also thinking, too, that, you know, when somebody starts to prepare for a ritual, you know, maybe they take a sacred bath, they they're setting the space up to do a ritual. It's almost like getting ready for lovemaking, in a sense. And I would imagine maybe you're getting into that theta state, maybe you're releasing the oxytocins then as well.
Well, a lot of people, I'm thinking of, Living in the Heart by Melchizedek, I'm thinking about how it is so important when you're doing something of this nature to move out of your head and into your heart. You know, all it really takes is an open heart. Not that that's so easy, but with practice we learn how to be in the heart. And when we're in the heart, we are in the love field, and that's the best way to get deep quickly.
Now, I might have the wrong hormone, but isn't it the oxytocin that there was this study, I think, done at UCLA about they were comparing men and women under stress, and they say women, you know, they don't sort of push the panic button. You know, it's not this fight or flight thing that men tend to do. Women, they get together in their circles of women and they try to figure out the problem. And I think they said something about oxytocin being part of why they respond differently to stress. Am I remembering this right?
Yeah. You have that right. When women are under stress, they seek the company of other women, and this is called the tend and befriend response.
Right.
And in the company of other women with some kind of basic understanding, we care for each other, and we know that the way to do it is to enter that oxytocin field. And, you know, gosh, I mean, I've done it. I'm sure you've done it for, you know, women relatives or sisters or daughters or, I mean, we know what that is. And now a study has basically identified it and given it some, a name, you know, we have a name for it. Yeah.
Yeah. Now it's scientific.
Yeah.
So we're talking about this in terms of somebody who's, you know, still has menses, but what about when a woman's in menopause? Do they still have this, you know, this cycle? I mean, how does the cycle change then if they're not bleeding anymore?
Well, Christian Northrup, who wrote Women's Bodies, Women's Wisdom, did some really wonderful research on this with Mona Schultz. And what they found was that during menopause, women release huge amounts of follicle-stimulating hormone and luteinizing hormone. Now, don't glaze over on this. These are hormones that are responsible for causing cycling women to release estrogen and progesterone. And this really stumped them because they thought, why would a woman do this when she's past her fertility? What is the purpose of this? I mean, the levels were hundreds of times higher. And then it turned out that these high levels of these hormones, that these hormones actually served as neurotransmitters for the right hemisphere of the brain, which I believe accounts for the wisdom of the elder or the visionary capacity of the older women. Oxytocin will always be available to older women. I mean, love is love, and the older we get, the more we understand how important it is to choose love. But at the same time, we have this bonus from the neurotransmitter stimulating the right hemisphere. And we also have, interestingly enough, ever-rising levels of testosterone. So the natural inclination of women as they age to be more forthright, more outspoken, and more powerful, if only society would let them, is biologically based.
Wow, that's really interesting, and it just sort of, well, it sort of substantiates, you know, what, you know, some of the new ideas in the women's community. I mean, you probably heard about the, you know, they used to think about, you know, maiden, mother, crone were the three, you know, three phases of a woman's life. Well, you know, there's some people like Ava Park and Donna Hennis who've started to say, well, wait a minute, we're missing something in there between mother and crone. What about queen, you know?
Yeah, I don't know when they did that, but in our book, Carol Leonard and I, the Women's Wheel of Life, you know, it came out in the mid-90s. And in this book, we didn't call it the queen, we called it the matriarch, but it's basically the same thing.
Sure.
And for Carol, who was really the impetus for this project, she was enduring a long winter in New Hampshire, and she's an artist, so she decided she'd paint a mural on in her hallway, and she wanted to paint a figure for every season of the year. So for the maiden, it was easy, you know, the young woman with the flowers in her hair and the springtime, and for summer, that was easy too. It was the mother with a full belly and representing, you know, birth and all of the integrity of that season. And also very easy for winter. There was the crone with, you know, the silver hair and the sprig of holly or whatever else, but not really anything for the autumn.
Mm-hmm.
And here is where Carol painted an image of, I guess you could, the queen or matriarch, whatever you want to call her, with a cornucopia of harvest at her power point in life. So in this book, we say that the maiden represents innocence. The mother represents nurturing. The matriarch or queen represents power. And the crone represents wisdom.
It's beautiful. Absolutely. Well, and I didn't know about that. So that's that will be interesting to share with some of the other women I know. It'll be another resource for that concept.
Well, yeah, ElizabethDavis.com. If you, you know, any listeners want to know, you can find you can access all of these books there.
Okay. So now, what about the woman who is all right? So, well, we know that all right. So the oxytocin is really about achieving that heart space. So yes, even the menopausal woman can go there. But does it matter though that she isn't bleeding anymore, or that's really not that big of a factor in this?
Well, all I can do is relay my own experience and the experience of other women. I'm 61, so I've been through it for a while. And I went through kind of early when I was 49. And, I was the youngest in my circle of women and was struggling with some of the symptoms and really wanting some help. And of course, you know, my girlfriends had all kinds of ideas about take this tincture or rub progesterone cream or whatever else, until I finally said, you know, I really don't want to know what to do as much as I want to understand what is happening to me. So I asked a group of women in my community, older women in my community, if they would hold a council and talk to those of us that were either approaching menopause or just or starting to go through it, and just share their experience. And their bios were so telling that one of the women said she, at the age of 61, she walked through the menopause door and became queen of her own country. Another said, at the age of, you know, whatever age she was, you know, 53, she flipped the menopause dial and started listening to her own voice. And so that was what I needed. That's what I want. I wanted to know what the transition was really for and how I could make the most of it.
So am I hearing you then, Elizabeth, what you're saying? You're no longer the childbearer, and that's fine, because now you're really in your phase of empowerment. You're just shifting phases, because I think some women get the idea once they're not bleeding anymore, they're somehow less than. We're really in a way, they're not less than, they're just as much or more than, they're just different.
This is what I would say. I'd say take the high point of your cycle, how good you feel when you're ovulating, mix in a little of your premenstrual passion, and imagine having that all the time. That's what menopause can give you.
Well, you see, then menopause has gotten a really bad rap, hasn't it?
Yes, it has. Yes, it has. And, you know, with fear and with hormone replacement, you know, which essentially stops the process temporarily or puts you in suspended animation, but eventually you've got to go through it. Or with surgery, removing the uterus and ovaries so no testosterone is produced. Testosterone is a really important component of the drive that activates this new hormonal mix. You know, you've got to have everything intact to really make the most of it. And
so you need the testosterone to move into your queen?
No, to move into your crone. You're probably already in your queen when you're in your mid to late 40s. You're really in your power time. You may still be raising children. You're also dealing with aging parents. Your career is at a peak. You're rocking everything. But the transition through menopause is the transition that takes you to the wisdom years.
So I'm just curious, this might be a little off subject, but we hear so much about hormone replacement being such a dangerous thing, causes cancer. Is that all true? Or?
Yeah, that's all true. And it's been true for a long time. I've known about it for years. I mean, you know, I read about it in obstetrical books, gynecological books, like, you know, 25 years ago. It's just information that has been kept from the general public.
So,
and
then,
partly the misinformation has caused women to seek hormone replacement when they didn't realize they had other options.
So then that may be something for our listeners to sort of perk up their ears if they're getting to be in that part of phase of their life. Hormone replacement is not the only option. They can do something that's safer that may not put them at risk for cancer.
Yeah, I've talked a lot about these climactic moments in women's lives that in other cultures are called blood mysteries. And these would be the first menstruation, childbirth, and menopause. And what all of these times have in common, the reason they're called blood mysteries is that obviously they represent changes in our bodies and to some extent in blood flow. I mean, first blood, childbirth, it's obviously different. Menstruation, I mean, menopause, we cease bleeding. But what also happens in a relatively short period of time is we enter a new phase of life, and that's the mystery part. What all of these mysteries have in common is the behaviors that we demonstrate when we go through them. And due to the volatility of our hormones in these periods, we more or less go wild. Other cultures have honored that wildness and seen it as a marker for society. They've revered women as visionaries in these times. They've not tried to tame them or curtail this wildness, but rather have supported it and even encouraged it. So we're in a culture that doesn't do that, and that means that women think there's something wrong when they start to have emotional meltdowns or feel emotions that they've been able to repress, perhaps rage or disappointment or sadness, that are actually just really coming to a head to be released so the next phase of life can be lived completely. Now,
well,
you know, this may take some support, and that's why I called for this menopause council, because I was going through this and I wanted to know what it was really all about.
And well, let's face it, a lot of us really, you know, some of us may not have anyone to ask. I mean, even our mothers, if our mothers are still alive, they may not know, they may know less than we do because they're from that generation that nobody
right.
talked about this stuff, you
right.
know.
Right, that's true. Well, there are supportive, I mean, the Women's Sexual Passages is very detailed and supportive around the menopause transition, and so is the Women's Wheel of Life. And sometimes ritual can really be significant in helping a woman feel acknowledged and cherished and safe as she moves through this transition or any of the transitions.
Well, and I'm
I never had a ritual for my first menstruation, you know.
Which
but
of us did?
I see women doing this. Yeah.
Well, yeah, now it's a new trend, but, you know, I think
yeah.
most of us looking back, it was, you know, I can remember I was 12. I had on a white dress at school, and of course that's the day it starts. And I get home, and yeah, my mother had given me the little book. I'd seen the film in school, but I'll never forget how empty I felt when, you know, back then, you know, it was a belt with that you put the Kotex pad on.
Yeah.
And she just handed me this. Well, here, you're going to have to use this now. And that was it.
Yeah.
You know, I can remember feeling really depressed after that. And, of course, I couldn't put words to it at 12, but it wasn't a very positive experience.
Yeah. Yeah, I had a similar experience, except that my mom was a little more positive and my dad congratulated me. And that really meant a lot to me.
Right.
You know, I've shared this story in my writing and also when I speak that for my daughter, who is now 38, she was 10, and I was headed off to my first midwife conference when we had just founded the National Midwifery Organization called MANA. And for whatever reason, right before I left, I got her, you know, some pads, and talked to her about everything and showed her how to use them. And she did start when I was away. And she said, you know, like, Mom, how did you know? And I thought, well, how could I not know? I'm a midwife. And I felt the waves of her. What I feel in women's intensity in labor when contractions come closer and closer, I felt that in my daughter, in her mood swings of, you're not the boss of me, to, oh, mommy, 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 getting closer and closer. I could feel it coming. And that's what I mean when I say there's something that our blood mysteries, you know, something in, that they share. I think that if we only knew this, if we only understood and incorporated this and honored this, we would have the most phenomenal women's culture. And we'd really have a platform for some of the work that we want to do from the ground up.
Absolutely. I mean, it just makes me, again, one more thing to be angry about the patriarchy for. Well, and I'm thinking, too, you know, we have these, you know, these red webs and red tents now for the younger women, you know, getting in touch with their menstruation. But, you know, these need to be expanded. I can so easily see for, you know, for older women to understand the next phases, too. It doesn't stop. Obviously, you know, just when you have a better relationship with your monthly cycle, you know, there's a lot more to it.
Well, when we did the Women's Wheel of Life, Carol and I, we were in our mid-40s, and we were at this place of thinking, now, wait a minute, there's got to be more to the second half of life than we've been taught. And as we created this wheel, it's got, you know, 12 stages that are somewhat chronological but are also archetypes, with a 13th in the middle that we call the transformer that essentially makes the web that allows you to move back and forth across the wheel, not necessarily marching chronologically. We showed this model to women younger than we were and also older than we were because, you know, we didn't know how to talk about the older stages. We didn't have that experience. And many women said that they felt that in our culture, it was preferred that women never went beyond the nurturing stage, that you know, innocence and nurturing were fine, but to move into power and wisdom was really a challenge.
Well, that's way too scary for our society.
Yeah.
I mean, look what's going on in the news right now. I mean,
right.
You know, are we really fighting these battles over contraception? These men are scared to death.
I can't believe it. I know.
They should be so ashamed of themselves. I mean, if they only knew what they looked like. But of course, they're certain they're absolutely right and entitled. But that's another subject.
Well, fear of the feminine and fear of the mystery and fear of the unknown and fear of where we are right now in our remarkably rapid evolutionary period.
Right.
I mean, this is an aside, but I certainly feel like change is accelerated right now to a level that I'm actually really happy with.
I mean, in terms of
my interactions with people, my conversations with people, I can't believe the depth of conversation I am having with strangers at this point in time. So,
no, you're absolutely right. I'm getting goosebumps hearing you because everybody is saying that. We're definitely tuned in. Now, the men must be too. We have the ones that are our brothers and are with us, and we have the ones that are scared to death and trying to push us into the dark ages.
Mm-hmm. Well, and some women too.
Yes, they're
unfortunately,
handmaidens.
Yeah.
That's sort of what we call them, the handmaidens, complicit in their oppression.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Liz, we probably have about 10 more minutes, so I want to get to a couple other things real quick. Any studies about the benefits of sex? You know, when we're denied sex, maybe because of no partner or whatever, anything in your research about, you know, you need sex for a healthy, happy life, or just curious about that?
It's so tremendously helpful for stress reduction.
If nothing else,
the hormones
right?
we release, like, dopamine and all of that, and yet stress really interferes with desire. This is something that women, really busy, active women like myself, have to juggle because the more we are under stress or accomplishing a multiplicity of things and the more we're running adrenaline and going crazy with everything we're doing, the less we are able to get into that oxytocin field and really enjoy sex. So here we have a choice. You know, we can turn on that adrenaline and use it when we need it, but we have to know when to call a halt and say, now I'll switch that dial, and I want to go into this field, and I want to have more pleasure because I know this is really good for me, not just physically, but spiritually too.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. And we've talked a little bit about ritual, but was there more you maybe wanted to say about the importance of ritual in women's lives?
I think that ritual needs to, it's a learning curve, you know. I learned ritual in the company of other women, and now I have daily ritual that is highly personal and completely delicious that I can't wait to get to. And if we all had that level of ritual, I think we'd really want to do it. It's not supposed to be artificial or burdensome. It's supposed to be something that is centering and brings us into wholeness and into the deepest, biggest place we can be. You know, we have ideas about meditation that are largely male model, where, you know, we have to sit still and there's sensory deprivation and we have to focus, whereas it seems that more women access these places through movement, through art, through you know, a number of ways, through gardening even. Anything that we do that takes us to ourselves is, in my mind, ritual, especially if we become conscious of it and choose it on a regular basis.
I see. So it doesn't have to be lighting a candle or burning incense.
No, it doesn't. Although maybe, you know, that's part of your ritual.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But it's nice to have ritual because it's stabilizing, especially if it's something you can do either first thing in the morning or last thing at night, just as a way of bringing in the energy that you want to launch the day in a fresh frame, or to end the day that way.
Okay.
I mean, yeah.
Well, I guess let me close with, I mean, we've covered a lot, probably more than I thought we'd get to, and it's been wonderful. Is there anything you want to share that I've neglected to ask you?
Well, yeah, you know, there's one thing that I do want to say to women around contraception. I do want to talk to them a little bit about the birth control pill. And I want to support women in making whatever choice they wish to make with contraception, and I know that oral contraception is a very convenient and appropriate model for lots of women. But something I think young women or women, you know, of childbearing age should realize is that when we take the birth control pill, we alter the rhythm that I described earlier in the show of the peak with ovulation and the peak premenstrually, because we simply don't have those peaks. And this has been demonstrated that women that are on the pill are hormonally monotone. They don't have the heightened experiences. There was a study done, it's a very weird study, but they did it around scent, and they had a number of male volunteers who agreed to wear a T-shirt for days at a time with no antiperspirant, limitation around alcohol and cigarettes and certain spicy foods, so that all that would be in the shirt would be pure scent. And they separated the groups of women into one group that was on the pill and one group that was not. And the women on the pill were required to go up to these shirts that were in boxes and essentially sniff through this little opening and pick a shirt that had a scent they found most desirable. The women that were not on the pill picked shirts of men who had immune systems that were complementary to their own. But women that were on the pill picked shirts of men that were essentially kin with the same immune system. They picked men that were more like family members than, at a genetic level, appropriate mates.
What did that mean?
Well, what it means to me is that when you're on the pill, your perception of Mr. Right as somebody who might have a be biologically complementary to you is distorted by the hormones. And it's just an example of what a significant intervention the birth control pill actually is.
Again,
I'm not opposed. I understand how complex a world we're in. But this is the kind of information that I have in my book, and this is the kind of information I think women need to make an informed choice around their contraceptive method.
Very interesting. So in other words, they would, so maybe I misunderstood, they would choose someone that was maybe like more like their brother, more like their father, rather than somebody who was really their the right Mr. Right for them.
Yeah, their count, their complement.
Their complement.
Yeah.
Very
yeah.
interesting. Who would ever have thought it? Wow.
Who would ever have come up with such a study? But there
well,
you have it.
I know. All right, so we're about out of time here now. This has been so interesting. I'm so glad we had a chance to talk, and I thank you because I know it was late for you tonight. So the two books that we were talking about primarily were your Women's Sexual Passages and Women's Wheel of Life. Do you ever give workshops? And what part of the country are you in if you do?
Oh, I teach all over the world. I mean, I just got back from 2 days in Hawaii on orgasmic birth. I mean, if people want to get in touch with me, ElizabethDavis.com, and you'll see all my works and some articles and, you know, a list of my recent appearances and ways to get in touch with me, upcoming events as well.
Wonderful. Well, Liz, thank you so much. It's really been fun, and I so appreciate you taking the time, you know, to share all this wonderful information with my guest tonight. Really, really appreciate it.
Thank you, Karen. It was fun for me, too.
Okay,
good night. I'm so glad we did it.
Me too.
All right, good night.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Well, listeners, I promised you that I would end the show with the Bee Mantra by Lane Redman. So we have just about enough time to get through most of the mantra. So I'm going to go ahead and start it. And if memory serves, it might start off a little bit slow. So if you hear dead air for about 10 seconds, not to worry. Okay, here we go with the Bee Mantra by Lane Redman. And I just want to thank you for tuning in tonight. I want to remind you that this weekend is St. Patrick's Day. Remember, some scholars say when St. Patrick drove the snakes out of Ireland, that was a metaphor for Christianity driving goddess religion out of Ireland. But alas, Bridget is alive and well, and her energy is ever potent on the Emerald Isle in spite of St. Patrick. That can certainly give us a new twist for our celebrations this weekend. And spring begins next Tuesday, so go outside. Go outside. Get away from the computer. Hug a tree. Commune with nature. Or watch Avatar. And be sure you're back with me next week. I have Danica Anderson with us. She's the author of the book Blood and Honey. We'll talk about women surviving post-traumatic stress of warfare. And then in the second half of the show, Leigh McCloskey. He is the author, and he's an author and an artist of sacred art, the creator of the Sophia Temple at Olandora in Malibu. And later on in March, we have Barbara McGraw with us talking about her new book, Taking Religious Pluralism Seriously, and Nane Jordan. Her topic is women's spirituality education in the academy. And then later on in April, we're going to have Barbara Walker on the show, as well as Barbara Marks Hubbard. So good night, listeners. Thank you for tuning in with me. Once again, may Goddess embrace you in her golden wings. And here is the Bee Mantra by Lane Redman.